This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Will be damned if the same politicians who refused to act then are going to try to come back today.
The real content of any kind of revolutionary thrust lies in the principles and the goals that you're striving for.
When the powerful use their position to bully others, we all lose.
A system of justice will be the richer for diversity of background and experience.
And correction. Hello, everybody. It's me, Miss Cracker. I'm here with my co-pilot.
Are you recording?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't even see you press record. Okay.
Hello, everybody. It's me, Miss Cracker. I'm here with my co-pilot, Caitlin. And it's time for She's a Woman. It's a podcast for every human being who looks into the mirror and says, "She's a woman!" And for the people who love them. Every week, we talk to incredible women of all kinds from all walks of life and invite them to share their stories with you, our incredible listeners. And that's exactly what we're going to do today, Caitlin. All right, Caitlin, let's talk about the zoo because we went to the zoo for a whole 6 hours.
We went to the Bronx Zoo.
Yeah, my friend Dan, Safari Dan on Instagram, he works with the zoo a lot. And so he gave us the inside scoop on all the animals, not just the names of the species, but the names of the individual animals in the exhibits.
I know. I learned so much. For each animal, he had a, like, fun fact about them.
Yeah.
Like, several fun facts about them. He knows so much.
Yeah. And I thought we were animal enthusiasts. This guy.
I know.
He was like sweating. You know what I mean?
I know. And he was wearing a tiger t-shirt. And I was like, oh, you dressed in theme for the zoo. And he was like, I always wear these type of shirts. I was like, oh, okay. I had a great time because, you know, listeners, we love any and all animals.
We do.
And the Bronx Zoo is an especially good one to go to because they are very well funded. Is that right? And they do a lot towards animal efforts. And a lot of the animals there were rescued from horrible situations and maybe would have been killed otherwise. And I know there's lots of zoos that are problematic and just in it for entertainment, but the Bronx Zoo really cares about the animals
And a lot of the species that are there exist only in zoos now. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much extinct in the wild. And they're part of projects that are just to keep those species alive and in some cases maybe release them into the wild again.
We saw a lot of baby animals.
And I was like,
wow, there's lots of babies here. And Safari Dan was like, that's because they have a breeding program here to try and revive some of these species that are really, really endangered.
Yep.
So it was super interesting. Also, I found out from my mom, who texted me after seeing my Instagram story, that they have a whole show on the Animal Planet. The Bronx Zoo does.
They do?
Yeah. It's like 5 seasons.
Animal Planet, here we come.
Yeah, it's called, I don't know what it's called. I think it's just called The Zoo or something. But it's about the Bronx Zoo and all their efforts to save the animals. And my mom was like, I think you're at that zoo that we watch on Animal Planet. I was like,
okay.
So, you know. Fun fact. We gotta watch it.
Not to be confused with Zoo, the great show in which animals fight back and take over the world, which is also available on Netflix. It is the worst show that has ever been released on television, and you have to watch the first episode because it's so dumb.
Isn't that kind of like the movie Madagascar?
Yes, but this is serious.
Oh. But isn't that the cartoon Madagascar, don't they like start in the zoo but then
yeah
escape and then somehow end up on a plane to Madagascar? Is that okay? But this is like a drama?
This is a drama about animals fighting back and taking over the world. This lady gets attacked by a whole bunch of cats. They're like, we've had it. It's a good one.
Interesting concept. Do they talk or no?
No. Oh. No talking. Oh. Huh. It's just okay. Like, yeah. It's not for kids. It's okay. An adult drama.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I'm kind of curious, but also...
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Concerned. Anyway, that's a perfect lead-in to our little thing for today. I want to dive right into our interview, but first I have a little treat for you, Kraitlin. Every week we do a little segment called Here's the Good News, where we share positive stories torn from the headlines. The idea is that they'll bring you, our listeners, a little hope during these difficult times. And this week, our news is all about the mascot of She's a Woman podcast.
Also, I want to say that Ms. Cracker is so excited for this good news because she texted me twice this morning before noon and was like, I can't wait to talk about our good news today. And so I'm really curious to learn about what you've got for us.
You're going to like this, Caitlin.
Okay.
The first time I talked about this topic, it was just by chance. I ran across an interesting article in the Times, and I was like, oh, cool, this makes me happy, let's talk about it. The second time, I just wanted to follow up on the first story. By the third time that we talked about this on the podcast, I realized I was obsessed, and now I'm just admitting it. Giraffes are the mascot of this podcast at this point.
This is definitely like our third or fourth
story. This is our fourth giraffe story.
Oh my gosh. We love them. We love them.
But it's not just giraffes, but it's what they stand for, because news about giraffes, okay, fine, but is what it means for the animal world that really gets me. So here's the good news. For years, scientists assumed that giraffes are very simple creatures. They don't seem to socialize too much at first glance. They move slowly. They look aloof, as a New York Times article puts it. But after careful observation recently, science is changing its mind. Now scientists believe that giraffe culture, giraffe society, may be much more complex and interconnected than we ever thought. According to the Times and stories from this groundbreaking pioneering podcast, hello, female giraffes are now known to enjoy years-long bonds. We talked about that. They have lunch buddies, stand guard over their dead babies, and stay close with their mothers and grandmothers. Females even form shared daycare-like arrangements called creches, in which they take turns babysitting and feeding each other's young. Lady giraffes.
This is a really crossover of our interests.
Yeah. So observations like these have reached a critical mass, said Zoe Mueller, a wildlife biologist who completed her PhD at the University of Bristol in England. Okay. My favorite place in the world.
And you did a University of Bristol podcast.
I did. She and Stephen Harris, also at Bristol, recently reviewed hundreds of giraffe studies to look for broader patterns. Their analysis, published on Tuesday in the journal Mammal Review, suggests that giraffes are not loners, but socially complex creatures akin to elephants or chimpanzees. They're just a little more subtle about it. So here's why I think this is important. Conservation practices today allow hunters to hunt older giraffes because it's assumed that they're not important to giraffe life, that you can just kill grandma giraffes.
Not the grandmas.
Yeah, but studies like these are showing that giraffe grandparents may be just as important as parents, which means that those hunting practices could and should be changed. And giraffe feminism also in there.
Without the older giraffes, then younger giraffes don't have anything to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
They teach each other, right?
That's right. And I guess grandparenting is just as important as parenting in giraffe life. So, I don't know. I think this is good news because it shows that there are scientists out there fighting for animal rights just by teaching us the basics about them, because there's so much we don't know.
I know, and we've definitely talked about this before, but there is so many things we don't know about animals, and we just always assume that their brains are totally different than ours. Mm-hmm. And in some ways they are, but in a lot of ways they are just like us.
Yeah, and we come from that. We were animals. We are animals, so we have so much in common. And assuming that, I don't know, assuming that any part of an ecosystem or a herd is not important is like ridiculous. It all works together that way for a reason.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that is our good news today.
And it shows that ageism exists in all...
aspects of anything that humans look at. They're ageist. Yeah.
Gosh.
Anyway. But yeah, lady giraffes. Notice that this article says, according to the Times, female giraffes do all of these things.
Yeah.
Male giraffes just hit each other with their heads.
That's why it's a perfect story for our podcast.
Exactly. Lady giraffes, if you're listening, we appreciate you. All right. Enough about that. Let's take a little break. Okay, we're back. Now, before we continue, let me say this. If you enjoy your time with us today, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. We love reviews. In fact, we love them so much, we're going to read some of our favorite reviews right at the end of the show. And now, Caitlin, my dear friend Ben, who's living in Mexico, he wrote a review...
He did?
Of the podcast, and I think we should read it after this. Maybe we'll read that at the end of this episode. But he left high praise on our podcast.
Okay, good, because he's very smart.
He's a smart guy. Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, good, he likes it. And that just goes to show, if you are friends with us and you assume that we don't need to hear from you because you told us in person, we love hearing it on the, on the podcast app. Yeah.
We need praises from all... mediums.
From all mediums, yeah. And Mom, it's time.
Yeah,
you and Sylvia, you guys get on there and rate and review.
Foster,
we expect, you know. We expect it. You are in marketing, you know. Anyway, it's time for the meat of the episode, everybody. It's time for our interview. And Caitlin, I was researching Maysoon Zayed, who is our guest today, and I was just blown away by how perfect she is for this podcast. How did you discover her? Do you remember? Was it an late night Instagram scroll?
I think it was a late night Instagram scroll. Or I don't know, sometimes I go on these, like, in these rabbit holes of, I decide I want to learn more about a random topic.
Yeah.
I think I was just trying to think of how to expand the type of guests we have on podcasts, and I think that there's so many arguments going on out there and about how the world needs to pay more attention to some of the disability laws and things out there. And I think I just went on a rabbit hole on that topic one night and found her and thought she would be a great fit.
Well, she's gorgeous. She's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
She's a woman. Let's dive in.
Yeah.
Maysoon Zayed is an actress, comedian, writer, and disability advocate. She is a graduate of Arizona State University and a Princeton Fellow. Maysoon is the co-founder, co-executive producer of the New York Arab American Comedy Festival and the Muslim Funny Fest. She was a full-time on-air contributor to Countdown with Keith Olbermann and a columnist for The Daily Beast. She has most recently appeared on Oprah Winfrey Network's In Deep Shift, 60 Minutes, and ABC News. Maysoon had the most viewed TED Talk of 2014, which discusses her experience of cerebral palsy, her life, her family, and so much more. So, Maysoon, I have spent the last day diving into all of your incredible comedy and your features on Countdown and interviews with Queen Latifah, and you're so magnetic, and I just want to ask you the three questions I always ask to start. Where are you? How are you? What are you doing?
I'm in Jersey in my basement, where I've been pretty much since the pandemic started. I went from touring and doing 200 stand-up shows a year globally to doing like 500 virtual shows a year in my basement. And I'm very much looking forward to getting back to live events. So if you people could get vaccinated, that would really, really help me. How am I doing?
That's a good one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. How am I doing is good. I'm blessed and privileged because I have a very cool cat and I am alive and a lot of people are not alive and I don't live in an active war zone. So that's also kind of fun. I'm bored out of my mind. I definitely want to go back on tour and I'm at a very, very weird place right now because I'm on the edge of almost. So I have a comic book series coming out with Scholastic. I'm pitching a docuseries to major networks this week. And I have a Muslim Christmas movie coming out in the next Christmas season, not this one, but nothing is happening right now. So like, I feel kind of like, is any of this real? Because everything is really hypothetical. So I'm kind of feeling bored and ungrounded, yet blessed and grateful.
Wait, I have to ask, do you get imposter syndrome when you're in periods like
that?
Oh
gosh, no. No, no, no. I don't have imposter syndrome. I'm bitter that I'm not a cisgendered, able-bodied, straight white man syndrome because I know that if I was, I would be hosting The Late Show.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I'm the opposite of an imposter. I'm like, I'm so much better than you people know.
Oh, wow. I love that. And the third question is, what are you doing right now? And I think you're sitting in your basement losing your mind.
I'm sitting in my basement losing my mind. I'm writing the final draft of my comic book for Scholastic that I'm super excited about because it centers a disabled child of color who does not get healed in the fantasy world. So like too often when we see visible disability, like a wheelchair user, an amputee, or someone who's blind, when they become a superhero or they're in the dream world, they're healed. But this character's not, because I wanted to show that like disability is cool. You don't have to be healed. You can still live in a fantasy world and be gimpy. And this week, literally this week, I'm meeting with the five biggest networks in the world to pitch a docuseries called Welcome to the Disco that I'm partnering with the director of the documentary that was nominated for an Oscar called Crip Camp. And she and I partnered and we're doing something like, it's like Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations, but instead of eating food, we eat disabled people. And I've been watching a lot of TV. So like last night I watched the season finale of The Bachelorette and that was fun.
Well, I was going to ask you, and you're kind of answering it a little bit, like, just to be clear with our audience, you're a hilarious comedian and you turn all of life's challenges into laughter. And I'm kind of wondering, were you able to use comedy to help you survive during the pandemic, or was it just boredom that took over?
No, yeah, comedy definitely helped me survive the pandemic because it was all stranger than fiction. And comedy is like taking the ridiculous and making it even more ridiculous. So I loved having the opportunity to reinvent myself as a virtual comic. You know, the first 3 months I was like, oh my God, my entire livelihood disappeared. And like, I'm a spoiled brat. I'm a mean girl that like masquerades as an empathetic, like advocate for the underdog. But like internally, I'm a mean girl and I like stuff. And like in one phone call, all of my finances were gone. All of my income was gone. All of my shows were canceled. And I had no idea what I was going to do. And I had spent 20 years on the road. So it was really fun to be able to like, okay, I'm going to sit in front of a camera. I'm not going to hear my audience. And I'm going to do this. And I recreated myself as a virtual speaker and a virtual comic. And then all the time that I wasn't flying gave me the opportunity to write these incredible, incredible projects I miraculously managed to sell that I don't think I would have sold if it wasn't a pandemic. Because normally you have to fly to LA for all these meetings. I live in Jersey and that costs money. And like, I didn't have it. But since I could have my meetings in the basement, I was able to sell 3 projects in 1 year. So yeah, it was really exciting and fun and a huge, huge challenge. But also I want to catch up your audience. So for the people in your audience who don't know me, in the Oppression Olympics, I'd win a gold medal. So I'm Palestinian, I'm Muslim, I'm a woman of color, I'm divorced, I'm disabled, I live in Jersey. So like, you can't be more oppressed than me.
You won. You won this podcast just now.
I win. If I meet a transgender person that's the exact same criteria as me, I'm going to have to cage fight them to the death because I can't have anyone be more oppressed than me. Yes. No, it's actually a joke and it's not true because obviously like Black women who are disabled are more oppressed than I am. Ugly women who are disabled are more oppressed than I am. I look like the lost Kardashian. That gets me through a lot of doors. My disability is shaking. That's kind of sexy, you know? So I'm not really at the bottom of the barrel.
You have made a lifetime of being unapologetic and turning these challenges into comedy. And right. I think that we flinch so much from these topics, all of the challenges that you face and all of the ways that you're different. And you use comedy as sort of like, I don't know, the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down is how I always put it.
I always say, like, I became a comic 1 year after 9/11. I was a Palestinian Muslim living in Jersey, went from being like your average snooky type of Jersey girl to like public enemy number one, who was literally having like people boycott outside of my shows saying I was coming to impose Sharia law and calling me a terrorist and whatnot. And I realized that like I didn't want to use comedy ever to like lecture or teach or preach. It was always like make them laugh first. But in that moment, I realized if I can make people laugh, then they're less likely to kill me. They may still do it, but they're less likely. And I realized that like the best way to talk about stuff, and I don't like the word humanize. When people are like, we have to humanize. You don't gotta humanize me. I'm clearly a human. Like I'm not here to humanize myself. But I think the best way to talk about people, to talk to people about stuff they simply don't want to hear about is through comedy. And I think that right now in this nation, I find it terrifying that there's like an entire cult of people that have no sense of humor. So like you try to joke with them about stuff and they're just like, you know, screaming like hate and bigotry and violence.
Yeah.
And I've never in 20 years of doing stand-up comedy, never have I seen such a virulent lack of ability to listen, laugh, and love. Never. And like, as I said, like I hang out in war zones. I've been shot at a checkpoint and I've still gotten soldiers to like chuckle as they put their, you know, gun to my head. Whereas right now I try to talk to people and nothing is funny to them. It's very scary.
Can you talk about that for a second as far as where do you think that is coming from?
I feel like it's too simple to say what I'm about to say, but they seem utterly disconnected to reality. So blinded with hate and rage and privilege that they truly can't hear anything that goes against what makes them feel superior.
Not wanting to give up power, and to laugh is to give up a little of your power.
Exactly. It's vulnerable. It's human.
Yeah.
It's connecting with someone you don't want to connect with. Because if you see me as an equal, then that destroys your entire being. Because their entire being is hinged on, I'm better than you. You're inferior. You don't deserve equality. You're a threat to me. And we're like, you're physically a threat to me, dude. Like, stop being afraid of me imposing Sharia law as you step on my neck.
You know, I experienced this in a much smaller way because I am a cis white male once all the makeup and hair comes off. But when I see people, I'm like 5'5". I'm walking down the street in drag and people are losing their minds.
Losing their minds.
Like screaming and yelling at me as if I'm a threat. And I'm like, most of these people are like a foot taller than me. So I'm just like, I promise I'm not scary, especially in flats. You know what I mean?
And since you asked me, what do you think that visceral reaction to you is? The fact that you refuse to just fit into the box, like, what is their reaction to you? I have another one after you tell me mine that I can't wait to tell you about. You're going to enjoy this one.
In my life, I've found that I automatically have a knee-jerk hate to things that I have in common with. Like when I had really bad acne as a kid, I just hated people that had bad acne. And so I have to imagine that people that scream at me and hate me, because it's not everybody, have something in common with me that they don't like. And so maybe they want to do what I'm doing, or maybe they think I represent something that they're interested in, and it's upsetting. So, like, I have tried to grow out of that knee-jerk thing in my life, and, you know, I think other people could, too. What's your, what were you going to say?
So the other thing is that, like, the clear haters, they're really easy. The ones that are a real challenge for me are the people who fancy themselves as progressive, as allies, as equality junkies. And then I go into their high-powered Hollywood meeting and I watch women, women specifically, which makes me sad because, you know, we're supposed to uplift each other, in the meetings react so negatively to me. And I know exactly what it is. Again, there's a huge amount of privilege, right? And it's very scary for them to see a disabled woman of color who is more confident and more powerful than they are and doesn't flinch or bow to all the pressure around her. So like when I go into meetings, I don't let men speak first. I make jokes if there's a lack of diversity. I'm like, which one of these is not like the other? And I think they fought so hard to get in their position that when I walk in completely irreverent and I don't follow any of the rules, it makes them feel bad because they're like, how is the disabled brown chick more confident than I am? That's not how it's supposed to be. And they're gatekeepers. These are the gatekeepers.
And I think I have to think that a lot of your attitude comes from the way that you grew up and the fact that you had a family that absolutely would not take no for an answer when it came to giving you the best life. So before we go on and talk about all of the things that you are working towards, I just want to rewind for a moment and ask about your deep past, what you were like growing up and the moments that made you, because I think this is, I think it's your family is a beautiful story.
So I say that my dad was a teddy bear and my mom was a tyrant, and they perfectly prepared me for my life in Hollywood. So my dad was like the, you know, my dad was the ultimate cheerleader. When I was born, the doctors who delivered me said I would never walk. Now, there's absolutely no shame in not walking or using like whatever mobility device you feel frees you. But like at the time I was born, the ADA wasn't signed. There weren't a lot of options. And so my dad was like determined to teach me how to walk. And he taught me how to walk by dangling a dollar bill in front of me and having me chase it. I mean, think about that. Like there was something so visceral about like childhood me. It was like my inner stripper is so strong. I'm going to do this. But then like he was the guy with like the giant video recorder on his shoulder at dance recitals while my mom went back to college. So my mom had four kids by the age of 26, four girls, and then went to college and became chief of lab of the largest like medical center in New Jersey, Jersey City Medical Center. So I really only recognized her from pictures, but she was failure was not an option. So like you didn't get to come home with B's, you came home with A's. There was no playing the disability card. Like my sisters each had chores and I was like, I can't clean, I'm disabled. She put a towel under my butt and put me on the kitchen floor and was like, scrub. She's like, you can crawl, you can do this, you know? And like, to this day, I always tell this joke, but it's completely true. I was on 60 Minutes and I called my mom and I was like, did you see me on 60 Minutes? And she was like, yes, your hair looked terrible. And I don't resent her for it because guess what? She was right. My hair did look terrible. The next time I did better and I looked very Beyonce. So like, I don't think of it as a bad thing that my mother constantly challenged me, never gave me breaks because I was disabled. And when I say never gave me breaks because I was disabled, she wasn't like, you shall become a cardiac surgeon. I don't care if you kill them. It wasn't like that. It was just kind of like, no, you're not going to you know, skip college and go straight to Broadway. You're going to go to college, waste money on a degree that teaches you nothing about entertainment, and then come back 4 years later and too much older to really audition. And that's what I did. And it worked out perfectly, you know, so that's who I came from. And then I had three older sisters. So I was born in a Palestinian Muslim family with no brothers. So the four women were treated completely equally. And my dad was like a huge girl dad. And he was like, my girls are going to college and my girls will pick who they want to marry. And we didn't like live under this like picture of Muslims that Americans have, where you're like covered in a burqa and forced to get married at 8 years old. And so they raised us super, super proud of who we were and super strong women. And so I think that's an integral part of me. Part number two, super important. Parents were too poor to afford physical therapy and occupational therapy. So they sent me to tap class and piano. Now, to be clear, my parents were upper middle class. But before 1993, people with pre-existing conditions couldn't get insurance. And nobody can afford physical therapy and or occupational therapy without insurance. Like you can maybe get 6 weeks. But up until 1993, we weren't allowed to have insurance. And that's why every time they try and overthrow the ACA, the disabled community gets really, really nervous because we could be back to being uninsurable in a heartbeat. So instead, they sent me a tap class and to piano. Piano for my hands, tap for my body. And so I was a performer from the age of five. And I was getting standing ovations every single show. And I had no freaking idea that people were standing for me because I was disabled. Because social media didn't exist. So if social media existed, a clip of me dancing on point to Bette Midler's Wind Beneath My Wings would go viral with some hideous headline like disabled girl conquers everything to shakily spread her wings. And I would have been horrified, realized that people only clapped for me because I was disabled and not talented, and I would have quit. But luckily, I didn't have any of that. So I loved the stage. I loved TV, and I always wanted to be an entertainer. So that's another part of the deep part of me. And then the equality part. The reason that I'm like so obsessed with equality is that while all my friends were going to Jersey Shore, my parents sent us to Palestine to live in a war zone. So I grew up watching people being discriminated against simply because they were born the wrong faith. So like, in house A, you're born one religion, you get everything. House B, you're born another religion, you get nothing. And I just couldn't wrap my brain around the fact that people were separating each other based on skin, on gender, on who you love, on religion. Like, it just never made sense to me. And that's why I've fought so, so hard for disability rights, which have just been lost in the shuffle of the civil rights movement. And disability intersects with every community. So disability rights also tackle racism. They tackle reproductive rights, equal pay, healthcare, you know, women's rights. It all intersects with disability rights. And that's really what fueled my passion to be a disability rights advocate.
You mentioned in one of your interviews that you didn't experience bullying either for your identity as a Palestinian or as someone living with cerebral palsy when you were younger. It wasn't until you encountered social media that you really got to experience that. Yeah.
I was never bullied. I was never made fun of. I grew up in a completely Italian Catholic town. The only house that Santa skipped every year was mine. I should have been mercilessly, mercilessly bullied. I was never, ever bullied. I was never made fun of. Then I become a comic. When you're a comic, people heckle you. But it's not bullying. You know, it's like, oh, thank you. You know, like, it's not like personal. So 10 years into my comedy career, I get my big break and I get cast on, not cast, but I get invited to be a contributor on Countdown with Keith Olbermann, highest ranked primetime show in cable news at the time. And I went on, and right after I went on, I Googled myself, because that's what you do when you're on TV. And people were calling me an honor killing gone wrong. They were calling me a crooked Gumby mouth terrorist whore. They said that I looked like Botox gone bad. They said they wanted to rip my lips off my face because they were so annoying to watch. They said like the most vile, disgusting things. And the next time I was invited, I literally like stopped for a second. And I was like, do I want to go back on TV and have the World Wide Web make fun of me? And I was like, fuck yeah, of course I do. I'm not going to throw away 20 years of work because, you know, Benny in Mommy's Basement, by the way, now that I live in a basement, I feel like it's karma for me always making fun of the basement dwellers.
Poor
I'm
Benny.
I'm not going to let some dude that's never seen me and says I have chunky knees stop me from like pursuing my dream of taking Meghan McCain's seat on The View. Like,
yeah.
You cannot let strangers control you. It is much harder when the person bullying you is your family or your spouse, and it's someone who's harder to get away from. But I see a lot of people letting people online tear them down, destroy them, affect their mental health. And all I can say is like, the block button is your friend. You don't owe anybody anything. Strangers do not get to define you. Only you get to define you. Real life issues, I understand, are much harder to battle. But when you're being trolled and harassed and threatened online, block, 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 and then Google cats on glass tables, clear your mind and go back to being you and having fun. You can't let them win.
I need to hear that, because I will, I look at the comments sometimes, you know, everyone goes like, well, don't look at them. And I'm like, I'll go for a month without looking, and then you just have that one day where you're like, I'll have a peek, and then you dive, and then you spiral. So, yeah, no, I think you're right, and I'll take Meghan McCain's spot as well.
Well, let me just talk quickly about Meghan McCain's spot. Everybody's like, it has to go to a conservative. It has to go to a conservative. Like, the only other view in the world is a conservative view. Like, if you're looking for a different opinion, are you telling me that anyone's ever heard a visibly disabled woman's opinion on The View? It's never happened. You know how many times Meghan McCain said like the most obscene, awful, racist things about Muslims? A lot. It would be really fun to have a co-host go on and be able to counter all of that. You know what I mean? But I really wish this country would stop thinking that hate is a valid opinion. And then it's like the opposing opinion to people who want equality. I have nothing in common with Joy Behar, Whoopi Goldberg, or Sarah Haynes. Nothing. Like nothing at all. No opinion they've ever given matches my opinion. But my opinion isn't given the weight of the Ku Klux Klan. Why is that?
Speaking of giving hatred a voice, you have tried to give a voice to people who get a lot of hate. And part of that effort has been the New York Arab American Comedy Fest. Can you talk a little bit about how it started and what your goals were?
First thing is first. I started the New York Arab American Comedy Festival 18 years ago, one year into my career. And if I knew what I knew now, it would have such a shorter name. It could have just been Arab Comedy Fest. What the hell was I thinking? New York Arab American Comedy Festival. It's like 97 words and 18 vowels. So if I could do it all over again, it would just be Arab Comedy Fest. At my third comedy show ever, I met this comedian named Dean Obidala. And as soon as he walked in, I knew he was Arab. I was like, that dude's Arab. And there were no like other Arabs in the game. So I went up to him, I introduced myself. A year later, he reached out to me post 9/11. And he was like, do you want to do a show with the Arab comics? And I was like, I think that's just me and you. And he's like, yeah, I found like three other guys on the street. They'll join us. Let's do this. And I was like, okay. So we did an Arab comedy show and it sold out. It sold out the New York Comedy Club. So now think about this. I'm a new comic. I'm looking for like a sellout show. And I'm like, ooh, this Arab comedy thing works. So Dean and I are like, why don't we start a festival? Why don't we start a festival and we can have sketch and film and stand up and we'll gather all this Arab talent and we will redefine Arab talent in Hollywood. Because post 9/11, we were either taxi drivers, terrorists, belly dancers, or wearing a burqa. But prior to that, we were like the gods of comedy. You had Jamie Farr on MASH, Kathy Najimy and Hocus Pocus, Danny Thomas, Make Room for Daddy, like Tony Shalhoub. We were the OGs of comedy. We wanted to show Hollywood that we had the talent, but we also wanted to kind of fight against the negative representation of Arabs and Muslims in media by reminding everybody that we were American. And that's really the reason that the name was so long, because it was super important for us to establish that Arabs were not others, that Muslims shouldn't be sent back to their country, that it wasn't okay that George Bush was registering Muslims post 9/11 while pretending to be like non-bigoted and visit a mosque. You know, we were all under surveillance from 2002. I'm a stand-up comic, so I'm always talking to my FBI agent. Like, I'll be on the phone and I'll be like, how funny is this? Like, you're listening to me dictate an entire memoir. Like, are you laughing? Do you go back to your friends and be like, I have the best gig. Maysoon is the best person to spy on. Why doesn't the guy from the BBC love her? She likes him so much. Why doesn't he love her? So it was what everything in my life is. It wasn't all pure motive. Part of it was like, I found a racket. I found something that no one else was doing that sold out. There was a big Arab audience because they breed like bunnies and they were feeling really sad with the run up to the Iraq war. So we had a good audience. And then by 2010, we really transitioned into having like a global and national audience. When we started doing our Live Nation tours, it was no longer just Arabs coming to see us. That's when the audiences really got diverse. And then in 2011, I did a tour called The Muslims Are Coming. And
I was just about to ask about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Me and Dean went to the Deep South and we did shows in communities that had like peed on Qurans and put like bacon on Muslim people's cars because they think like bacon is our kryptonite.
And there was a documentary about that, correct?
The Muslims Are Coming.
Yeah. What was that experience like documenting that journey through the South?
It was the most poorly planned trip of my entire fucking life. So Nagin Farzad, who was the producer, she planned it for August in the Deep South. Okay, do you know how hot it is?
Yes,
in,
I
like,
do.
Alabama, Tupelo, Mississippi. But wait, there's more. It was Ramadan. So I was fasting every day until 8 o'clock. Then the shows would be at 8 o'clock. So I'd basically like break my fast on water. And then we'd be in bars and there'd be no food. And they'd be like, do you want a shot of whiskey? I'm like, yeah, I want to break my Muslim fast with a shot of whiskey, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And then on like the 11th, I'll never forget it. On like the 11th day of the tour, this is a totally true story. We were at Elvis's birthplace in Tupelo, Mississippi. And I passed by a statue of Elvis and he talked to me and he said, if you don't drink water right now, you're going to drop dead. And I broke my fast and I drank water. And like the whole rest of the tour, I was drinking water. Anyway, one of my favorite stories was every night after the shows, I would try to go eat and there was never food because everything would close at like 10 o'clock. Because again, it's the Deep South.
So we know that we tour too and we feel your pain. Continue.
Like now I take Lunchables wherever I go with me on tour. I just have a stack of like pizza Lunchables. So I always have food. So anyway, we were like packing up and I was like, move. I'm like, the last place that's open closes at 9 and it's like 8:45. And she's like, why don't you just go to 7-Eleven and get a bagel? And I go, because I can't eat a bagel and then fast for a whole nother day. Like, that's not how it works. And she goes, nobody told you to fast, Maysoon. And I said, nobody told you to make a movie about Muslims during Ramadan in the Deep South in August. and then like Dean kind of walked me away quietly. Then, and I'll never forget it. He literally walked me away quietly, sat me down with a cup of iced tea and a chicken wing. And I was just like, I'm so hungry. It was such a nightmare. And Harry Smith was with us. And I was like sweating. And in Alabama, there's these bugs that attach to your legs and they have a racist name. And I kept asking people, what are those? And they were telling me what they were. And I was like, what are you saying? And you have to pluck them off of your legs. But the best, like most enlightening part of that trip that stuck with me for absolutely ever was that Alabama was still segregated. So one night, Dean and I walked out to go get food, and we literally ended up outside of one restaurant where every single patron was white. And it wasn't like a fondue place, like where it's logical that they'd be white. It was just like two Italian places next door to each other. One was totally white. One was totally black. I was like, get your brown ass in the black one quickly. And like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, Obama is president and the South is 100% still segregated here.
So you're saying that diversity in government and in film and television doesn't mean there's been a like tectonic shift in
America? Seismic shift?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know, Habibi. What I know is that 74 million people voted for the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan in November. So that's what I know. That's what I know.
Wait, okay, so we just talked about representation a little bit, and that reminds me, you had an experience, or you talked about an experience where you were auditioning for a part in college.
This is a great story.
So tell it. You'll tell it better than me.
Okay. So since I was 5 years old, my dream in life was to be on General Hospital. I pursued that dream by going to Arizona State University. And I got A's in all of my acting classes, but I didn't get cast in shit. Like, I couldn't even play, like, Diner Number 3. I didn't know what was going on. Senior year, they decided to do a show called And They Dance Real Slow in Jackson. It's about a girl with cerebral palsy. I'm a girl with cerebral palsy. So I'm like, yeah, free at last. I'm finally going to get a part. I don't get the part. Sherry Brown gets the part. I never even change her name in these stories. She's lovely. She reached out to me on Facebook, and I feel bad for her. But at the time, I didn't. Anyway, she was a non-palsy Christian Scientist, and she got the job. And so I went to the head of the theater department, and dude, I was so dramatic. This is a totally true story. My dormitory was adjacent to the theater building, and you could climb from the balcony of my dormitory into the second floor of the theater building where the offices were. And I did that day, which I totally shouldn't have because I'm palsy and I could have cracked my skull open, but I wanted to make a dramatic entrance to prove that I should have gotten this part. And so I go to her office. I'll never forget this. I go to her office. Her name was Jean Thompson. And I said, can you explain to me how I didn't get a part? I was literally born to play. And she said, you can't do the stunts. And I said, if I can't do the stunts, neither can the fucking character. And she told me to get out of her office before she kicked me out of the program. So then my fellow theater students like formed like a full-on protest, and the school got like nervous that it was going to get like sued or something for discrimination. So they put me in the next show, which like wasn't even supposed to happen. They like made it happen to kind of cover their butts. And I played Frida Kahlo, and I was so dedicated that I grew in my eyebrow. So my senior year in college, my first year that I could go to clubs, I walked around with a freaking burp brow from Sesame Street.
Yes, you have burp brow. I was born with one of those.
I was like, I don't need no makeup. I'm Arab. And so then when I went out to audition in the real world, I realized that college again had really prepped me well for Hollywood, because Hollywood doesn't cast disabled people in roles that are written disabled. They cast stars. They don't ever consider us for roles that are not written as disabled. So where I did see myself was in stand-up comedy, very specifically Richard Pryor, the original shaking comic of color. And that's when I was like, I'll become a comic and then I'll do movies with Gene Wilder and the rest will be history. And here I am. And 20 years later, I got on General Hospital. I play Zara Amir as a lawyer, a family court lawyer.
Yes. So, dream achieved. What can our listeners do? What can we do to support disabled people playing disabled roles on the stage, on the screen?
First and foremost, you boycott any movie or TV show that has a non-disabled person playing visibly disabled on screen. Just like we got Scarlett Johansson, you know, to pull out of Tug and Rub, we need to not be okay with Bryan Cranston playing a paraplegic or The Rock being an amputee or Freddie Highmore doing whatever atrocity he's doing on The Good Doctor. Boycott vocally anything that casts non-disabled people in visibly disabled roles. And outside of media, follow disabled talent on Twitter. There's a hashtag disability Twitter. There's film dis and there's the disco. Disco is short for disability community disco. If you follow those hashtags, you're going to see amazing actors, writers, dancers, musicians. And if you are creating things, reach out to disabled creators and include them. You know, people with disabilities are 26% of the population. So some disabilities are visible like mine, some are invisible. And you need to always create a space where disabled people not only participate because it's the right thing to do, but participate because there's an immense amount of talent in the community that has been ignored. So if you're a creator and you can include them, include them. If you're a viewer, support their work and boycott work that exploits them. And if you are Bill Gates, you've done really bad things in your life. And I think you would feel better if you gave me $100 million the way that Jeff Bezos gave that to Van Jones, and I'll help the disabled people. Okay? Okay.
That sounds like something that each and every one of our listeners can do. That's really easy. You don't even have to move off your sofa. All you have to do is support disabled people in disabled roles. One of the things I want to ask, though, before we head out, you've been on General Hospital, which is your live stream. What is next? What's the next dream for you?
I want The View. I'm not playing about The View.
You're not
the
playing about The View.
No, I'm not playing about The View. In September, they're going to have like a guest host run the way that Jeopardy did before they gave it to the guy who runs Jeopardy, whatever the hell just happened with that. But in September, they're going to have a bunch of people come in and guest host. All I want is that one shot, that Hamilton one shot. Put me in for one shot. There's never been a visibly disabled co-host on television. Women with disabilities feel unsexy, unseen. We're not treated as adults. Having that voice be put on the largest platform in daytime would be so empowering to so many women. But also, I really do think that, like, I'm great at panels. I spent 20 years being a stand-up comic and a public speaker, moderating panels, doing Q&As, doing what you and I do now. And I'm curious and I'd like to learn about things. So often the co-hosts don't even read the news story that they're commenting about. I have like encyclopedic knowledge of politics, pop culture, sports. The only thing that I can't discuss is money because I have no idea like what economics are, how much a dollar is worth. I know nothing about money. But like
pretty much
anything else I can discuss. None of their co-hosts have ever lived in a war zone. I have lived in a war zone. I've worked in refugee camps. I've been in the Middle East while it was being bombed using U.S. armaments. I bring a view to that desk that has never, ever, ever been seen again. And then I would finally have a job that makes enough money where I could guarantee to keep myself out of assisted living. Because if this past year taught us anything, it's that disabled people in America are currently disposable. And if we don't take care of ourselves, society definitely won't. So I want that view bag so that I can make sure that I have like a nice chick named Lydia to take care of me the rest of my life.
All right, we're clipping that out and we are sending it in to the producer. Because that's the one of the most impassioned speeches we have ever had on this podcast. And I want it now.
I do too. I'm willing to also take the Friday only spot. Whoopi Goldberg takes off Fridays and they've had like Paula Faris and Anna Navarro. I take one day a week. I'd settle.
I want to thank you so much for today.
I hope our paths cross again soon and we work together someday.
I hope so too. Thank you so much. All right, Cradalina, that was our interview for today, and she is fiery.
I know. It's great to hear about all these like obstacles she has, or that she, but she doesn't think of them as obstacles. Do you know what I mean? I melt down if I oversleep for 30 minutes, and I'm like, what's my excuse? I need to calm down. Yeah,
she's very good at reminding you that if you are awash in privilege, you can calm down.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things that she says that we didn't get to talk about is that she does not want to be viewed as, quote unquote, an inspiration. You know, she doesn't want you to look at her and be like, look at you, like, great job. Like, she doesn't want that from people. She wants to get the credit for what she does and all that she achieves. And she doesn't want, and she specifically says, I don't want your pity. You know, just give me what I deserve, which is apparently a spot on The View.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I found her thoughts on social media and how...
She's not here for it.
Yeah, how she wasn't bullied before social media came around.
Yeah.
I thought that was super interesting.
So if you really like this interview, I would suggest going in on YouTube and looking at Maysoon Zayid, because she has great TED Talks, she has great interviews, she's really fantastic to watch, so... I'm very glad we had her on today and can't wait to support her more. However, having said that, Cradalina, it's time for us to take a little break. Oh. Okay, we're back. Now, first of all, I want to say this again. If you liked your time with us today, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. We love reviews. In fact, we love them so much, we're going to read some of our favorite reviews right here at the end of the show. Caitlin, do you have a review today?
I do.
Okay, that's the one.
That's the one? Okay. Yeah. You need this podcast in your life. I listen to all my podcasts at 2x speed, because who has time these days? But I listen to She's a Woman at normal speed because I want to enjoy every second fully. Extraordinary woman, moving stories, excellent interviewer.
Oh, Shabab! That's my friend Ben, everybody. Thank you, Ben, so much. That makes me so happy. Also, you are a nerd for listening to your podcast at 2x speed.
I know.
Who has enough brain power to understand at that speed?
I have tried that before, and I'm always like, what's going on? I feel like I can't actually listen to this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. For sure. But thank you so much, Ben, and all our friends and family. Make sure that you follow his great example and send in a little review. But enough about that. It's time for the credits.
Your favorite part.
My favorite part. This podcast was...
You have in trouble today.
I am. This podcast was... I'm not even like... There's no reason.
Like, did you get some sleep last night?
I got sleep. I'm not hungover. Anyway.
Did you have like a nice breakfast?
I didn't have a nice breakfast.
Oh, see?
That's not the most important meal of the day.
Yeah, it is.
This podcast was produced by Caitlin Gredham, and then I did it. The cast includes me and also Caitlin, and it is distributed by the amazing Studio 71. So thank you for joining us today. Make sure to tune in next Monday for another exciting episode. And remember, if you ever feel down, all you have to do is look in the mirror and say,
she's a woman!
And I'll be with you.
I almost forgot.
You almost forgot, but I waited.
I was like, oh yeah, it's my time.
Yeah. Oh my God.